It's about the depressing state of the NHS. Junior doctor Arjun Singh fears for its future.
If you're having people waiting 12 hours in waiting rooms before they're seen by a doctor, if you're having people having heart attacks and strokes in A&E waiting rooms before they're seen, well, that is a system that has collapsed. And the reason that it has collapsed is in large part because we've not funded our workforce properly. We can't retain doctors. You can't have a hospital in an NHS if your doctors are leaving so frequently.
According to the British Medical Journal, 4 in 10 junior doctors in the UK plan to leave the NHS as soon as they can find another job, at home or abroad. But while the trench warfare continues, delayed appointments have reached the 1 million mark, with the NHS's waiting list already at an estimated 7.6 million.
If the government has any hope of these doctors giving up their industrial action anytime soon, then today's double doctor strike should be a sign that that is simply not going to happen.
With both sides digging in their heels, the strikes could continue into another crippling winter. And for patients on the long waiting list, that could potentially mean months of more misery. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Palestinians keep descending further into poverty and de-development under the Israeli occupation. In a report released on Monday, the World Bank said poverty rates are stubbornly high, as roughly one out of four Palestinians live below the poverty line. Palestinian non-governmental organizations say the poverty is more severe in Gaza.
In Gaza, the situation is more and more catastrophic comparing to the West Bank due to the blockade and wars for the 16 years. We have high deterioration on the humanitarian conditions, also on the economic standards. Due to this blockade, we have food insecurity.
They say that the Israeli occupation and blockade are the main culprits behind the increase in poverty among Palestinians. The Abu Ajwa family in Gaza's Zaytun neighborhood, where more than a dozen people reside. Their average daily income is only around $5 a day. The abject poverty has forced them to live in miserable conditions.
Look at my house. It is falling apart and we can't afford to fix it. You can't even imagine how hard it is for me or for my family. Our living conditions and those of many families here are disastrous. We can hardly afford to put food on the table. Poverty has taken its toll on us, and I don't see any improvement to our situation anytime soon.
The situation of the Abu Ajwa family is just a small example of how thousands of people live in the tiny territory. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive as their incomes continue to dwindle. More than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been living under intensified access restrictions since 2007 and are largely isolated from the outside world.
The people who are in need for humanitarian assistance, 80% of the population, and most of them children, women, elders, who are in bad need for such assistance on time, we are suffering from shortage of funding for humanitarian aid. This will lead for more deterioration in the humanitarian and socio-economic situation.
Daily life is a constant struggle for most Gazans because of the inhumane Israeli practices.
According to experts, the Israeli regime is responsible for the high poverty rate and the near collapse of Palestine's economy, as well as its isolation from the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
According to the EU's own official data, 74% of small and medium-sized businesses within the 27-country bloc cannot find skilled workers. At the same time, millions of young people are unemployed. EU Youth Affairs Ministers met on Monday and Tuesday to discuss the crisis.
I think it's very obvious that we have a generation of young people who have been living through crisis after crisis since 2008. The financial crisis, the COVID pandemic, and now they're going through the consequences of a war at the heart of Europe.
The neglect of young adults in the EU was acknowledged last week in the European Parliament.
8 million young people are neither in employment, nor in education, nor in training. 8 million. Their dreams put on hold, their lives on standby.
Youth ministers have agreed to coordinate efforts across the EU to try and fix broken education systems.
One in every six Europeans has mental health problems. Not just young people, but also older people connected to loneliness and isolation, for example. Every European with mental health issues has a right to access help mechanisms.
It's a right, but experts say help is often unavailable. Apparently, there's a need to prioritize funding.
We have debts and deficits, so the challenge really is how to reconcile this continuous pressure on public budgets, which health is placing, with the broader macroeconomic context.
It is being suggested that allowing young people to fall through the cracks while focusing all resources on the war in Ukraine threatens the future of the entire EU project. According to campaign groups advocating for the rights of young people, the inability of the political establishment in the EU to bring about job opportunities is translating into growing support for extreme anti-EU political parties. It's thought this disquiet will become clearly evident in 9 months from now, when a record number of Eurosceptic candidates are forecast to be successful during European Parliament elections. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After years of negotiations, the European Commission has finally taken a position on the migrant issue, the harshest one. Brussels will in fact back the Italian far-right government's hardline stance on migration. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has welcomed a 10-point plan on migrants presented by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Lampedusa on Sunday.
I'm confident the issue of migration will be added to the agenda of the next EU summit in October. We must stop departures from Africa and swiftly deport those turned down for asylum. The future of Europe is at stake here.
Following a surge in migrant arrivals on Italy's shores, von der Leyen visited the southern island of Lampedusa on Sunday, where the situation has been tense since the start of the year, with thousands of migrants stranded in difficult conditions. Here, von der Leyen announced a new migrant action plan, which includes fighting trafficking, returning migrants to the countries of origin, and transferring migrants from Italy to other EU member states.
It is very important for me because irregular migration is a European challenge and it needs a European answer. So we are in this together.
Germany has promptly expressed its support for another proposal made by the European Commission President von der Leyen that concerns expanding air and naval surveillance of the European Union's external borders. Some experts are of the idea that such a measure would be against international maritime law, as EU ships would not be allowed to operate in territorial zones where only North African states have jurisdiction.
Air and naval surveillance of the Mediterranean by the EU would be equivalent to a warlike act. We all know what has happened to Libya after the French-led NATO attack there. All migrants' countries of origin must be involved in a more democratic process of handling the migrants. Also, von der Leyen's 10-point plan on migrants is full of inconsistencies.
Meanwhile, French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin made a lightning visit to Italy on Monday. In an interview to a French radio, Darmanin said that France is willing to help Italy to secure its borders, but it will not take in any migrants from the island of Lampedusa. Max Civili, Rome.
Sports is one of the fields that has made significant progress after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and today Iranian athletes shine in different international competitions. In terms of the number of medals, the 2012 Olympics in London was unprecedented for Iranians after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Iran left London with a total of 13 medals, 7 gold, 5 silver and 1 bronze, finishing 12th in the overall medal standings. But undoubtedly, Iran's national wrestling team has always brought colorful medals back home. And now, as the World Wrestling Championships is underway in Belgrade, Iran has already won 1 gold medal in the freestyle category. Greco-Roman wrestlers are well prepared for the World Championships as well as the Asian Games due in China's Hangzhou City.
We are very much prepared for the Belgrade World Championships. All the teammates are at the peak of their preparedness. After the Belgrade Championships, we have the Asian Games in Hangzhou ahead. I'm very much motivated and hopeful.
I've been a member of the national team for about 8 years now. I have a number of world and Asian medals. I'm quite ready for the Belgrade competitions.
Our Greco-Roman wrestling team is at its utmost readiness for the World Championship in Belgrade. The Belgrade event is of great importance because the medalists will be given the ticket for the Olympic Games. We are very much hopeful about winning medals.
Iranian athletes and especially wrestlers practice hard to get prepared for securing top places at global competitions, despite all the limitations which are imposed against Iran and Iranian national teams.
Also at junior level, Iran's national wrestling team has a good record to the extent that back in early August 2023, Iran's national junior Greco-Roman wrestling team ranked first in world championships in Istanbul, winning one gold, one silver and two bronze medals. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Iranian armed forces held military parades across the country on the first day of Sacred Defense Week. This annual event marked the anniversary of the beginning of an eight-year war imposed on Iran by then-Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. It is celebrated across the country to remember and honor war martyrs and veterans. In the capital, Tehran, the parades began at the mausoleum of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Different units of the Iranian army, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, law enforcement forces, border guards, and Basij volunteer forces participated in the parades. The participants marched in front of Iran's top military brass, as well as military attachés of the countries which have embassies in Iran. Representatives of different Iranian ethnic groups, including Kurds, Lurs, Turkmens, Arabs, and Baluch, also took part in the parade. Also in the event, Iranian domestic military products, including various drones and missiles, were put on display. One of the highlights of this year's parade in Tehran was the display of two Fatah hypersonic missiles and a Pava cruise missile. Addressing the parade in Tehran, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi praised the country's defense accomplishments and its capacity for weapons production, saying they show how the country's armed forces have turned the sanctions into opportunities.
We have transformed from a country that imported and stored other countries' weapons to a country that produces and exports weapons. Today, countries in the region and beyond admit that Iran's armed forces are powerful. They all agree that their armed forces have significant deterrent power.
Raisi also emphasized that a defensive approach aimed at ensuring sustainable security and deterrence was a fundamental policy of the Islamic Republic.
Today, war and domination have no place in Iran's military doctrine, but it's our definite policy to maintain military preparedness to achieve sustainable security and ensure deterrence.
The president underscored the fact that Iran's enhanced military capabilities, particularly in terms of training and equipment, are recognized both regionally and globally.
Today, the Iranian armed forces are stronger than ever and are fully prepared to deal with the threats of the enemies of the Islamic Republic. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. A prospect for peace seems to be remote as Russia and Ukraine have recently intensified strikes against one another. Western countries took more intent on flooding Ukraine with weapons and facilitating negotiations to end the war. The United States alone has announced its 47th package of military aid to Ukraine, which includes modern tanks and widely banned cluster munitions. This is while the Kremlin sees growing friction between Kiev and its Western backers, with its latest example in a spat between Poland and Ukraine over grain exports. Join us in our Spotlight program as we try to shed more light on the war in Ukraine with our guests. From Potsdam, Germany, spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Mr. Harley Schlanger. And Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who's joining us from Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Schlanger in Potsdam. U.S. President Joe Biden has approved the next batch of assistance for Ukraine, including artillery, ammunition, anti-tank weapons, and more Hawk air defense equipment. Also, the first Abrams tanks are to arrive in Ukraine next week. How has the Western aid fared over the course of the war, in your opinion? And what do you have to say about the ammunition and the arsenal that's being pumped into this war?
Well, let's start with analysis from very competent military experts, one of whom is Scott Ritter, another is retired Colonel Douglas McGregor, and then someone with excellent intelligence sources, Seymour Hersh. In the last 24 hours, all three of them pointed out that there's no chance in the world for Ukraine to win this war. And the message from all of them was that no matter how many more weapons are pushed in, it's not going to make a difference. And this was also what outgoing Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Milley has said. So the question is really, why are they continuing to do this? Now, the weapons that have gone in so far, look, when you have these kinds of accumulation of powerful weapons, it has an impact. And it is making it more difficult for the Russians. But the Russians are in a position where they're not allowing Ukraine to make advances. The counteroffensive is not working. There are videos out there of the German tanks and the U.S. armored personnel carriers in flames. The death toll in Ukraine is mounting. So I think the question that has to be asked for the United States is, why is the United States so intent on seeing Ukrainians die? And the answer to that is very simple. Their goal is to weaken Russia. And at this point, it's not really working. Actually, we're seeing Europe weakened and the United States is weakened.
Ken Stone, since the start of the war, lawmakers in the U.S. Congress, where Democrats now have a majority in the Senate and Republicans have a hold on the House, have maintained bipartisan support for assistance to Ukraine. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit on Thursday has come amid signs that the sands could be shifting, with some high-profile Republicans expressing growing skepticism over the steep price of continued U.S. support for Ukraine's for the war in Ukraine. Talk to us about the relevance of all of this right now.
There is declining support among the people of the USA and of Canada for this war. At first, people were pretty gung-ho about it, as is typical whenever the empire wages a war, whether it's a war on Afghanistan or Iraq or Libya. But as the war goes on, the population wakes up to the costs of this war, and they become less and less enamored with it. And right now, according to an opinion poll here in Canada, two-thirds of Canadians do not want to see the Canadian government send any more arms or money to the Zelensky regime. And at least a quarter, this was 6 months ago, at least a quarter of the Canadian population believes there should be a negotiated end to the conflict. So in Canada and the United States, this declining support for the war is being reflected in the United States in the position being taken by Republicans in the Congress who are getting more and more cold about giving more and more money and arms to Ukraine. They don't see the point in it, and it's bleeding the U.S. economy dry. I wanted to point out that during the first week of October this year, in 38 countries of the world, there will be a global mobilization to end the war in Ukraine. And we in Hamilton are having a rally on October 7th, a Saturday at 2 p.m. So the Republicans in the U.S. are they are, of course, in an intense rivalry with the Democrats. And so they are increasingly taking the position, especially those around Mr. Trump, that there should be no further support to the government of Ukraine.
Mr. Schlanger, despite Poland being one of Ukraine's staunchest allies, Warsaw has hinted that it will limit arms exports to its neighbor over a grain row. Is Poland, in your opinion, reflecting what other European/NATO countries are feeling right now?
Well, I think the issue for Poland is that how much of a price will the Polish people have to pay for a war that won't succeed? Remember, even before the grain deal, there was tension. There was a Ukrainian missile that killed someone, a couple people on the border of Poland, which they tried to say was a Russian missile, but it turned out to be Ukraine. Poland has been overrun by Ukrainian refugees. And now the grain deal, this is an important issue because Ukraine is shipping cheap exported grain to Poland, and it's undercutting Polish farmers. And the Polish farm sector is a major support group for the current government, which is facing an election coming up. But I think what the point you're making is true, that the war weariness is starting to hit all over Europe. We see it in Germany, where the current coalition government is now below 40% in the polls. All three parties together are I think, about 36%. And the leading anti-war party is now at about 22%. In the United States, the pressure on the House Republicans was so great that Speaker McCarthy had decided not to allow Zelensky to address a joint session of Congress on his recent trip to beg for more money from the United States. So the war weariness is real. What we're seeing in Poland is a very clear reaction. Similarly, Hungary is in the same position. Romania is trying to stop the grain exports. There's resistance in Greece, in France as well. So I think the escalation from Ukraine is an attempt to try to show that the money spent is worth it, but it's not really working.
Ken Stone, you mentioned reducing support for the Ukraine war in the United States and Canada and North America. It seems that waning support is now evident in Europe as well. Give us your views on Poland's recent stance. The Kremlin claims that, quote, tensions will increase between Ukraine and Poland and other European countries. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "We understand the tensions between Kiev and other European capitals will also increase over time. It's unavoidable." Do you agree with those comments?
Well, yes. The U.S. Engages in these military adventures under the guise of NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, to which Canada belongs, and gets dragged into every war of the empire. And there is no consideration about the consequences of the war. The war is made for the interest, the unilateral interest of the United States, and it's always about hegemony. The war in Ukraine is a proxy war to, in the words of our Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, to vanquish Russia. They want to do to Russia what NATO did to the Yugoslavian Federation in 1999, and that is to destroy it and gobble it up, gobble up the pieces. So they don't care about the refugee situation. They don't care about what happens to their vassals, you know, who are dragged into this, their European vassals in NATO, because once you join NATO, you lose your sovereignty and you become a vassal of the U.S. So with their bullheadedness, the U.S. has gone ahead and created a situation where they were hoping to, as your other guest said, hoping to economically as well defeat Russia. But it turned out the defeat economically was at the expense of the European countries, and especially the European workers whose industries are closing down because of the lack of cheap gas from Russia, and to the European farmers who see that their livelihoods are being threatened by the import of cheap and preferential treatment of Ukrainian grain. So these things are not going to get any better because the war is continuing to go on. And so the problem of giving preferential treatment to Ukrainian grain is causing severe problems. The Romanian and Bulgarian and I believe Polish farmers have set up barricades on the roads and the railways to try and prevent this cheap, preferentially treated Ukrainian grain from going in. But it still keeps going in. And meanwhile, the U.S. did not live up to the treaty that would have allowed Russian grain to be shipped through the Black Sea to parts of the world where they're really hungry, like as in Africa. So the U.S. cannot be trusted to keep any agreement it ever signs, and it cannot be trusted to do anything but what is in its own interest. And its own interest is only concerned with dominating the world, trying to defeat Russia, and then moving on to China. That's the game.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Shane, let's talk about this grain deal. Ukraine this week threatened to sue Poland, Hungary, and Slovakia over their refusal to lift a ban on imports of Ukrainian agricultural product. The Polish president, for his part, says he's willing to talk to Zelensky as, quote, friends to resolve the grain dispute. How big of an impediment can this serve to be ultimately? As many observers say, the grain deal has the capacity to actually affect this alliance.
Well, I think the grain deal is an excuse being used by the Poles. It's an important issue. And the fact that Ukraine is going to go to the World Trade Organization and file a complaint, they're going to go to various courts, they're serious about it. They're going to try and force Poland's hand. But that's not how friends cooperate. And without Poland, Ukraine would be in an even worse situation because so many Ukrainians have fled to Poland where they're being housed and protected. So I think the problem that Zelensky has is that his promises have proven to be false. The promise that the counteroffensive would change the war, that if you give me tanks, if you give me long-range missiles, it will change the war. The only thing the increased weapons are doing is increasing the danger of crossing serious red lines where Russia will soon consider NATO countries as enemies and may have to attack them. And under those circumstances, that's part of the reason the NATO countries are prepared to draw back. I would like to say one thing that in response to what Ken was saying about the U.S. interest. I know what he's saying. It's in the interest of the war party that runs both political parties in the United States, the corporate cartels that make foreign policy, that are the believers in the U.S. being the sole superpower. But that's not how most Americans think. And that's why the polls are showing a shift in thinking in the United States. And I just got a report today that various Polish American groups are protesting the treatment of Poland by Ukraine with the dumping of grain into Poland. So I think this is a losing situation overall for Zelensky.
Ken Stone, Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the U.S. and its allies to Ukraine could lead to worldwide conflict and even increasing the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Break down the likeliness of such events happening. And we must remember that earlier in the year, Russia and Belarus signed documents allowing for the placement of Russian tactical nuclear weapons on the territory of Belarus.
Well, I'm glad you picked on that example, because the Russian placing of nuclear tactical missiles in Belarus was a response to the UK announcement that it was sending, along with its Challenger tanks, depleted uranium shells to be used by those tanks in the conflict. And the point here is that every step along the way, NATO and the West, in this NATO war against Russia, have been upping the ante, have been escalating by, at first they say, well, we aren't going to send tanks. We aren't going to send depleted uranium. We aren't going to send F-16 jets. And then one by one, they cross Russia's red lines. And so Russia responded to the depleted uranium by placing tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. And following that, the U.S. government decided to send cluster bombs to Ukraine, even though these are prohibited weapons under a convention, which 110 countries of the world have signed, including Canada. And the Canadian government, for its part, said that it didn't like the fact that cluster bombs are being sent to Ukraine, but it was going to be business as usual, and Canada continued to send more arms and money to Ukraine. So it was just a token protest. The Russians, in return, said, now that you're using cluster bombs, the right to do so. Following that, the U.S. said that they were going to send depleted uranium munitions to Ukraine, and they did so, even though these weapons cause enormous health hazards, such as the Gulf War syndrome to American soldiers. It has caused multiple birth defects and cancers in Iraq, in Yugoslavia, in Syria, in Gaza, in Puerto Rico, where the U.S. tested them. We had a webinar about this the other night to prepare for our global mobilization. These are heinous weapons. The U.S. has sent them, and now Mr. Putin has said, we haven't used them yet, but now we reserve the right to use them. And so the escalation continues. We don't know at what point a red line might be crossed by NATO, which would cause Russia to treat, as you have said, some of the neighboring European countries where all these arms are being shipped in, to treat them as a co-combatant and launch attacks on them. This could start a wider European war or bring the nuclear powers into confrontation, leading to a Holocaust, which could wipe out human civilization on this planet. It's a very dangerous situation, and almost anything could provoke it, even a rogue officer who's got control of a nuclear weapon, or it could be an accident or a misunderstanding. What we really need is a pause, is negotiations to end the war. But it's clear that Mr. Biden, from his statements the other day when Zelensky was visiting, is not prepared to even consider negotiations. And that is a tragedy, because the fact that we are not talking means that the war continues and continues to escalate. It's really a dangerous situation for humanity, and that's the reason for the global mobilization in 38 countries of the world from October 1st to October the 8th.
Mr. Schlanger, I want you to address the same issue as well. We know that Ukraine launched a missile attack on the headquarters of Russia's Black Sea Fleet located in Sevastopol. That's the largest city in Crimea. As attacks on Crimea have intensified recently, there have been many warnings that this could escalate the war. Is the threat of this war morphing into something bigger and broader, just increasing as each day goes by?
Well, let me give you a little background to the idea of attacking Crimea. There are British think tanks, the Royal United Services Institute, which is the oldest defense think tank in Great Britain, with connections to the monarchy and the City of London. They were the ones at the beginning of the war who said, Crimea will be the turning point, taking Crimea. The various British organizations, the defense secretary there, minister, they've been saying we need the long-range missiles in Ukrainian hands so they can hit Crimea. And one of the officials of the defense ministry in the United Kingdom said they want to create a Crimean missile crisis. Now, in the last week, we've had a whole series of discussion about the targeting of Crimea, largely because of the Walter Isaacson biography of Elon Musk, which reported that Musk would not allow the Starlink satellite to be used to help targeting in Crimea because he said this would create a mini Pearl Harbor. Well, that's exactly the intent of the people pushing this. Again, it shows they care nothing for the people of Ukraine or the so-called freedom and democracy in Ukraine, which, by the way, there is no democracy there. It shows that the Ukrainians are designed to be the hammer, taking the brunt of the casualties in this attempt to destroy Russia. And so, as Ken was just saying, every escalation of this sort brings us closer to a decision from Russia that they will have to escalate. Now, we should be very thankful that Putin is not the kind of addled-minded figure such as Joe Biden, because Putin has continued to hold back the Russian attack forces and instead concentrate on the goals of the special military operation, which I would say are succeeding. They are degrading the Ukrainian military capability. Pretty soon, Ukraine won't have soldiers in the field. At that point, then what happens? Will NATO send in soldiers? How do you take Crimea without soldiers and without the logistical capabilities? So the war threat grows every single day that there's not a negotiated settlement. And there could be a negotiated settlement, but standing in the way, it's not Zelensky. It's Biden, it's NATO, it's Sunak. Their little puppet Trudeau is part of this operation, and they don't want a settlement.
Ken Stone, quick question for you before we wrap up the show. What is the end game for Europe here? Massive inflation, a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Some countries, like the UK, having its citizens face unprecedented energy bills, with many European countries facing energy rationing, and the list just goes on. Are European citizens on board with enduring all these hardships?
The quick answer is no, they are not. And you can see that in the huge demonstrations, much bigger than we've been able to stage here in North America. Huge demonstrations in Italy, Germany, France, Greece, many countries of Europe. And what the Europeans need to do is transform this unrest into coalitions, political coalitions that can unseat the vassal parties, the vassal leadership in Europe that is in tow to the U.S. empire. They have to get rid of these leaders who are in Europe, who are selling out their own countries and their own people in order to keep the U.S. government happy. That's what has to happen.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Harley Schlanger, spokesman of LaRouche organization, joining us from Potsdam, Germany. And Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joining us from Hamilton, Ontario. Thank you, gentlemen, for contributing to the program. It's good night for now and see you next time.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
According to a survey, a clear majority of investors anticipate that the U.S. economy will slip into recession by the end of 2024. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. According to Moody's Analytics, the typical American household spent $709 more in July than they did 2 years ago to buy the same goods and services. That figure underscores the cumulative impact of high inflation has had on consumer finances, even as price growth has cooled considerably in recent months. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, wrote in a post on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, "High inflation of the past 2 years has done lots of economic damage." Mark Zandi told CNN in an email on Friday, 11th of August, "Most of that increase in spending is driven by housing costs, which have surged." He added that families are also spending more at the grocery store, on buying, maintaining, and insuring vehicles, and on recreational services. Of course, paychecks have also grown over the past 2 years, but not by as much as the cost of living. Even though prices have soared, real earnings, which adjust for inflation, are stuck at late 2019 levels. Mark Zandi said, "Real earnings remain below what they would have been if not for the pandemic and the Russia-Ukraine war, which is weighing on the collective psyche." The latest news is that wages are finally starting to outpace inflation and consumer price growth has eased significantly, so much so that many investors are betting the Federal Reserve is done raising interest rates. Looking at just the last year, Zandi calculates that the typical household spent $202 more this July than they did a year ago to buy the same goods and services. That's significant, but it's still below the peak of $536 for this year-over-year metric, a record hit back in June of 2022, when gas prices spiked above $5 a gallon for the first time. According to a government report released on Wednesday, 9th of August, consumer prices increased by a cooler-than-expected 3.2% in July compared to a year ago. Even though that was slightly higher than the annual inflation rate in June, most of the impact was driven by calendar effects. Bank of America economists wrote in a note to clients on Thursday, 10th of August, "In sum, the report was encouraging. They wouldn't be surprised to see another soft inflation reading in August. Although month-over-month inflation readings are still likely to be bumpy," Bank of America economists said they believe that the current disinflation is not a head fake. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to new consumer price data released on Thursday, 10th of August, by the Labor Department, inflation ticked up to 3.2% year over year in July and 0.2% from June alone. This marks the first increase after 13 months of falling inflation, but that doesn't necessarily mean inflation is about to come roaring back. The so-called Core Consumer Price Index, or CPI, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, dropped slightly from 4.8% year-over-year in June to 4.7% year-over-year in July. The CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is one of several economic indicators that the Federal Reserve is watching as it weighs whether to hike interest rates again at its September meeting. While inflation has plummeted from its 9.1% year-over-year peak last June, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Jerome Powell told reporters recently there's still a long way to go before inflation returns to its 2% target. New York Federal Reserve Bank President John Williams recently said a September interest rate hike is an open question, while Federal Reserve Governor Michelle Bowman said recently that it will likely be needed. Economists said stubbornly high housing costs are perhaps the biggest barrier to bringing down inflation and interest rates. Eugenio Alemán, chief economist at Raymond James, said, "This better inflation reading does not change our view that the Federal Reserve is going to increase the federal funds rate at least once more before the end of this year." Eugenio Alemán added, "In order for this to change, there would need to be a strong decoupling between headline inflation and core inflation. But for that, we need a big slowdown in shelter costs, which we have been expecting for several months and has still failed to show up." High interest rates have been driving up the cost of mortgages, car ownership, and balance-carrying credit cards. Consumer debt ballooned $17.9 billion from May to June, and American credit card balances surpassed $1 trillion. The dual burden of high prices and interest rates has soured some Americans' economic outlook. Polling conducted recently by The Economist by YouGov found half of Americans think official inflation statistics understate the economic strain. 39% of the American public anticipate inflation would be higher in 6 months' time. The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a survey, a clear majority of investors anticipate that the U.S. economy will slip into recession by the end of 2024. The survey was conducted from 31st of July to 4th of August and involved 410 investors. The latest Markets Live Pulse survey, a weekly investor survey asking questions about different elements of financial markets, said nearly two-thirds of the 410 respondents anticipate a downturn in the world's biggest economy by the end of next year. The survey showed a minority of 20% of respondents have even seen a slump in 2023. Recently, ratings agency Moody's downgraded the credit ratings of 10 U.S. banks and warned of possible cuts to more lenders. Moody's announcement came after the ratings firm Fitch downgraded U.S. government debt rating in early August. Morgan Stanley's Michael Wilson told Bloomberg that Fitch ratings downgrade of U.S. government debt and the ensuing sell-off in the bond market suggest that investors should be ready for potential disappointment on economic and earnings growth. We'll be right back.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinian is critically wounded and a dozen injured after Israeli forces opened fire on protesters in the besieged Gaza Strip. Russian Foreign Minister says the current world order